Hello, this is William Fink of Christigenia.org, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, December 20th, 2024. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, I'm going to present part 16 of my Isaiah commentary, and this is titled The Burden of Moab, like it's a question. Which it should be, because the burden of Moab really has very little to do with Moab. Discussing Isaiah, before we move on from the prophecies of the destruction of Babylon and the fall of the king of Babylon, which are found in Isaiah chapters 13 and 14, it should be noted that at the end of Isaiah chapter 14, in verse 25, there is a shift in focus from Babylon back to Assyria, the demise of which Isaiah had already prophesied in chapter 10. Then in verse 28, there is an odd break in the context where Isaiah mentioned that this burden, referring to the prophecy of doom for Babylon, had come to him in the year of the death of Ahaz, King of Judah. Here it is unclear as to whether the reference to the death of Ahaz was spoken in relation to the burden against Babylon, which had preceded, or to that which would follow, beginning with four verses at the end of the chapter, in which Isaiah had warned Palestine of its coming destruction. It is more likely to have been a parenthetical remark, since with all certainty, the warning to Palestine here is contextually connected to the mention of Assyria a little earlier in a chapter, before that mention of the death of Ahaz. By itself, this also seems to suggest that the fate of Babylon is tied to the fate of Assyria. And that association is strengthened as the chapter proceeds, chapter 14. So immediately following the mention of the death of Ahaz, there are four verses containing the warning for Palestine, and within them there is revealed one significant element of the nature of these empires, where it states in verse 29, "Rejoice not thou, whole Palestina, because the rod of him that smoten thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent." The rod of him that smote thee would be a reference to Assyria, which had reduced and subjected Palestine, beginning with the reign of Tiglath-Pileser III, who listed Philistia among his tributaries in inscriptions from the 17th year of his reign. As we have also discussed, that is very close to the time when Ahaz had died, and Tiglath-Pileser had met his own end after having ruled for 18 years. Here we must state that the later Greek use of the term Palestine to describe practically the entire region later known as Judea is not what is meant by Isaiah here. As we have already explained, the word Palestine here is from the same Hebrew word translated as Philistia, or the land of the Philistines, elsewhere in Scripture. The Philistines continued to be distinguished in this manner as late as the time of the prophet Zechariah, who prophesied from about 520 BC. And in chapter 9 of his writings, we read prophecies concerning Damascus and Hamath, and then Tyrus did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire. Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful, and Ekron, for her expectation shall be ashamed. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. So in Zechariah's time, in the Persian period, it is apparent that the Philistines were still inhabiting the cities they held throughout much of the time of the Old Testament, even if he did not mention Gath, which I actually find no mention of from that time forward. That Philistia had also continued to be distinguished from the other nations in the region by the Assyrians is evident in an inscription of Sargon II, where we read in part, "To the kings of the land of Philistia," which is Philistia, it's Peliseth in Hebrew, it's Philistia in Akkadian or in the Assyrian language, Yaudi or Judah, Yehudi, I gather I should pronounce that, Edom, Moab, who dwell by the sea, payers of tribute and tax to Asher, my lord, they sent numberless inflammatory and disdainful messages to set them at enmity with me, to Piru, king of Egypt, a prince who could not save them, they sent their presents, or bribes, in parentheses, and attempted to gain him as an ally. Now, much of that inscription is lost in the lines which both preceded and followed that citation, so the precise context is not clear. But it is clear that where Isaiah refers to Palestine here, using the ancient word for the Philistines, his warning was meant for them, even if other nations in the region would also suffer in like manner, as Isaiah has seemed to warn in his other burdens in the chapters which follow. The Assyrians did indeed smite Philistia, but not yet at the time when Isaiah had written his prophecy. So once again, the prophet speaks of a future event as if it had already happened. Then not long after those words were written, in the inscriptions of Sargon II, that same Sargon, from a time which is about 10 years after the fall of Samaria, so it's rather late in his rule, we read, "Azuri, king of Ashdod, had schemed not to deliver tribute anymore, and sent messages full of hostilities against Assyria to the kings living in his neighborhood, on account of the misdeed which he thus committed. I abolished his rule over the inhabitants of his country and made Ahimidi, his younger brother, king over them. But these Hittites," and that's interesting, and we'll note that later, calling a Philistine a Hittite. "But these Hittites, always planning treachery, hated his reign and elevated to rule over them a Greek, who without claim to the throne, knew, just as they themselves, no respect for authority." In other words, they wouldn't respect the Assyrian authority. "In a sudden rage, I marched quickly, even in my state chariot and only with my cavalry, which never, even in friendly territory, leaves my side, against Ashdod, his royal residence. And I besieged and conquered the cities, Ashdod, Gath, and Asdudimu." I never heard of that particular city. "I declared the gods residing therein, himself as well as the inhabitants of his country, the gold, silver, and his personal possessions as booty." So he declared the gods of the Philistines as booty. I think that's amusing. "I reorganized the administration of these cities and placed an officer of mine as governor over them and declared them Assyrian citizens, and they bore as such my yoke." Apparently, Sargon II had used the term Hittite as a pejorative to describe the rebellious kings of the Philistines in a derogatory fashion. I guess Hittites were the niggers of ancient Assyria, because in many much early inscriptions, the appellation "cursed Hittite" is found, and it must have become an adage. Just a few years later, Sennacherib, I'll say, Sennacherib. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, wrote that in his third campaign, which was about the third year of his reign, he forced Tyre and Sidon under tribute, while all the kings of the Amorites, as well as those of Moab and Edom, had submitted to his rule willingly. But then, speaking of the Assyrians, an inscription recording his campaign says, in part, now Sargon II had just claimed to have destroyed Ashdod, the level of destruction is another story, and Gath, Sidkiah, I should pronounce this name, this inscription of Sennacherib. Sidkiah, however, king of Ashkelon, who did not bow to my yoke, I deported and sent to Assyria. His family gods, himself, his wife, his children, his brothers, all the male descendants of his family. I set Sharu-Ludari, son of Rukibtu, their former king, over the inhabitants of Ashkelon and imposed upon him the payment of tribute. Katri presents, that's a word that they couldn't understand the meaning of, so they didn't translate it, which happens often in these inscriptions. Not really often, but it's frequent. Katri presents due to me as overlord, and he now pulls the straps of my yoke. In other words, he's rebelling. In the continuation of my campaign, I besieged Beth Dagon, Joppa, Bene Barca, I'm not sure about that city, Ajura, cities belonging to Sidkiah, who did not bow to my feet quickly. I conquered them and carried their spoils away. The officials, the patricians, and the common people of Ekron, who had thrown Paddy, their king, into fetters because he was loyal to his solemn oath sworn by the god Asher, and handed him over to Hezekiah, the Judahite. Correctly, it's Judahite. And he, Hezekiah, held him in prison unlawfully as if he, Paddy, be an evil enemy. So the people of Ekron had evidently revolted against Paddy, their king, because he remained loyal to Assyria, and therefore they had seized him and turned him over to Hezekiah, who locked him in prison. Then a little later in the inscription we read, I assaulted Ekron and killed the officials and patricians who had committed the crime and hung their bodies on poles surrounding the city. The common citizens who were guilty of minor crimes, I considered prisoners of war. The rest of them who were not accursed, or I'm sorry, I'm misreading. The rest of them who were not accused of crimes and misbehavior, I released. I made Paddy, their king, come from Jerusalem and set him as their lord on a throne, imposing upon him the tribute due me as overlord. And the inscription never explained how Sennacherib got Hezekiah to release Paddy, since Hezekiah was also hostile to Assyria at the time. And as that same inscription continues, Sennacherib invaded Judah and took captive 46 of its fenced cities, and had thereafter placed Jerusalem under siege, even though the siege of Jerusalem failed. Where in the inscription, Sennacherib attests that his towns which I plundered, I took away from his country and gave them over to Mitinti, king of Ashdod, Paddy, king of Ekron, and Silibel, king of Gaza. So the Assyrians had indeed smitten the Philistines. Although once they subdued Philistia, the kings who were loyal to the Assyrians would reap rewards for their loyalty from the spoils of Judah. However, the people themselves had evidently seen the kings who were loyal to the Assyria as oppressors, which is apparent in the treatment of Paddy by the people of Ekron. So once Assyria had fallen, they would rejoice. But here Isaiah warned them not to do so, because out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. In other words, Babylon would be worse than Assyria. Reflecting on the words of that verse, in that clause it is revealed by Yahweh that the Babylonian Empire had originated from out of the root of the Assyrian Empire. So both empires essentially had the same origin, and kind begetting kind, their power was derived from the serpent who had engendered them. In an allegorical fashion, of course. And as we had also mentioned, this is in the same manner where we read of the beast in Revelation chapter 13, that the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. This concept is mentioned 3 times in that chapter of Revelation, so it must be a significantly important phenomenon. And here we also see it in Isaiah. As to the prophecy here in Isaiah, which seems to indicate that Babylon would be much harsher on Palestine than Assyria had been. Unfortunately, there are few surviving inscriptions from the rule of Nebuchadnezzar I or his successors. And the Babylonian Empire lasted for not even 70 years. However, while some of the Philistine cities have rather inconsequential mentions among them, there is no record of any battles with them. This tends to lend support for the fact that Isaiah's prophecy against Babylon is more relevant to the far vision and the entire series of empires which had followed after Babylon, as they had been prophesied in Daniel chapters 2 and 7. Daniel saying to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, that you are this head of gold, but after you there would be other empires. There would be 3 more significant parts of the body of the beast in his vision. While the cities of the Philistines endured through the Persian period, today the site of ancient Ekron is believed to be Tel Mikna, a buried archaeological site. However, the location has been contested over the past few centuries. Other hills or mounds have been identified with Ekron, and they didn't work out. The site of Ashdod, known as Tel Ashdod, has been in ruins for many centuries. Another buried mound of rubble. Ancient Gath has an uncertain location, but it is identified with an archaeological site known as Tel Es-Safi, which is also only a ruin. Alexander the Great was said to have destroyed Gaza around 330 BC after a siege of several months. Being a significant port, Gaza has been destroyed and rebuilt on more than one occasion since then. Ancient Ashkelon survived all of the other cities of the Philistines until it was destroyed by Muslims in the 13th century AD at the end of what is now known as the First Crusade. The ethnic identity of the Philistines had disappeared many centuries before that, and apparently even long before the beginning of the Roman period. It disappeared. They seem to have intermingled among the greater Greek population and Judean populations in the Hellenistic period. Now to begin our discussion of Isaiah chapter 15. Here in chapter 16, there is a burden for Moab. And after this, for what seems like several of the other surrounding nations, note I said what seems like, because we'll discuss that when we get to chapters 17, 18, 19. Damascus, Egypt, and even for a strange land described only in an enigmatic manner as the land with shadowing wings, or the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Having this discussion, we must ask whether these burdens against Palestine, Moab, Damascus, the land shadowing with wings, are for people of other nations, or if they are actually for remnants of Israel who had either taken refuge in these places or had been scattered among them. So we shall proceed as if either possibility is true. although we are certainly biased towards the later interpretation. In fact, we will demonstrate that tonight. Later, it shall become apparent that these warnings of Isaiah are not for Philistines, or Moabites, or any other nation. These warnings were actually meant for Israel, and for those of Israel who would seek refuge in those nations when the time would come that the judgments which had already been announced would fall upon Israel and Judah. Evidently, Moab was first mentioned in Assyrian inscriptions and a building inscription of Tiglath-Pileser III, which had apparently described a collection of tribute. And later, in similar contexts, in the annals of his successors, Sargon II, Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, and Ashurbanipal. So throughout the late 8th and early 7th centuries BC, for about 100 years actually, Moab seems to have been an obedient subject of the Assyrians, as there is no sign of rebellion in the surviving inscriptions. But that situation seems to have changed temporarily during the time of Ashurbanipal, as we read in an inscription recording his 9th campaign that during a general revolt of the people of Arabia, at the command of Asher and Ishtar, my armies, I mustered in the Gira, another untranslated word, in the Gira of the cities, Arzelu and Heratakase, in Udumi or Edom, in the pass of Yabrud, in Bit Amani, in the district of Horina, in Moab, in Sari, in Hargay, in the district of Sabiti, I slew many of his warriors. A decisive defeat I inflicted upon him. All the people of Arabia who had gone forth with him, I cut down with the sword. A little later in this inscription, Ashurbanipal records that a king of Moab named Kamashalta had been loyal to him and defeated some of the Arab opposition to Assyria in military battle on his behalf. The ancient land of Moab can be roughly identified with the modern Karak governorate of modern Jordan, which has a population of not quite 250,000 Arabs in a land which is quite barren and desolate. The northern border of the governorate is about 3 miles south of the Wadi Mujib, the current name of the ancient River Arnon, which was the former border of Moab. Examining the land on satellite maps reveals that it certainly has become a dry and barren desolation. With that, we shall commence with Isaiah chapter 15. The burden of Moab, because in the night, Arav Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. The word AR, basically, has several variations in Hebrew, and simply only means city. Likewise, the word Kir, Q-I-R in Hebrew, K-I-R in English usually. Kir is simply a wall. For that reason, a fortress. Variations of these elements exist in the names of British towns today, which had been settled by ancient Phoenicians and Celts, especially in the many cities of Britain whose names began with the letters Cair, C-A-I-R, C-A-E-R, or K-A-I-R, or E-R, names which end in the letters Castor, Kester, or Chester. They are all also related to this word Cair. In Welsh and other Gaelic languages, the word is actually said to mean forts, just as it may mean forts in Hebrew. The ancient city of Carthage is another example, Carthage, from a Hebrew phrase meaning new city, new Kir. It is evident and interesting that the Moabites may never have had proper names for their cities, but may have only called them city and fort. A longer name for Kir, Kir Harash, in Isaiah chapter 16, or Kir Harez in Jeremiah chapter 48, means wall of potsherds, shards of pottery, which are pieces of broken pottery. And the name seems to be a pejorative rather than the proper name of the city. Both of these cities, Kir and Ar, certainly were made waste, as the location of Ar today is not known with any certainty. And Kir is identified with the location of a modern desert town of perhaps about 32,000 Arab inhabitants, which is now known as Al-Karak. Verse 2. He has gone up to Bajith, B-A-J-I-T-H, and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medaba. On all their heads shall be baldness and every beard cut off. The Septuagint has the first phrase of this verse to read, grieve for yourselves, as Breton has it, where the word Bajith was evidently mistaken for another Hebrew word, Bekith, which is a weeping. The Dead Sea Scrolls Bible supports the reading found in the Masoretic text. This verse was not included in Field's edition of Origins Hexaplus, so that I could compare the various Greek translations. The word Bajith simply means house or family, but it is translated as a place name here and in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible. I don't always like the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, but it is insightful for telling me which words the Dead Sea Scrolls manuscripts have when they differ from either the Septuagint or the Masoretic text. The Latin translation of the Vulgate has a phrase which means the house has gone up. So they didn't translate it into a place name. They translated Bajith properly as house. So in the Douay Rheims translation, we read, the house has gone up and Dibon to the high places to mourn. And that doesn't really make much sense either, but I will get to that. Likewise, although they strangely translate the word for house as temple, the New American Standard Bible has, they have gone up to the temple and to Dibon, even to the high places to weep. The word for Dibon literally means pining or mourning, according to Strong's, who derived it from a word which means, who attributed its derivation from a word which means to mope or to sorrow. While Dibon was indeed an actual city in Moab, it was in the portion of Moab taken by the children of Israel and rebuilt by the tribe of Gad, which is explained in Numbers chapter 32 in verse 34. They seem to have shared the town as a border town with Reuben, which we see in Joshua chapter 13. But in spite of that, perhaps here the word should be translated with its common meaning. And Bajith, a Hebrew word which simply means house, is not even an identifiable place. So we may translate the same clause to read, the house has gone up to Dibon to weep, or even better, because that doesn't quite seem right either, the house has gone up sorrowing to weep. The Septuagint, as Breton had translated it, has this clause to read, grieve for yourselves, for even Dibon, where your altar is, shall be destroyed. There shall you go up to weep. And then a Hebrew word which means high place was interpreted as altar. But there is no word in the Hebrew text for the phrase shall be destroyed. Nebo. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba. Nebo was a town belonging to Reuben, which is mentioned in Numbers chapter 32. Medeba was also a town in Moab, which was located within the inheritance of Reuben. This we read in Joshua chapter 13. I'll read about 8 verses from verse 15. And Moses gave unto the tribe of the children of Reuben inheritance according to their families. And their coast was from Aroer. And I don't think Aroer is the R here, but that's a possibility, but that's not really that important. And their coast was from Aroer, that is on the bank of the river Arnon. And the city that is in the midst of the river, and all the plain by Medeba, Heshbon, and all her cities that are in the plain, Dibon, and Bamathbal, and Beth Balmaon. So far we have Aroer mentioned here, which could be R, but I'm not positive about that. So I don't even have that in my notes. Dibon and Medeba. And those cities are mentioned here as the cities that will be weeping, and they belong to Reuben. And Banathbal and Beth Balmaon and Jahaza. There's a Jahaz mentioned later, but it's in the land of Gad. It might be this one, as we shall see. I'll explain that also. And Kedemoth and Mephath and Kiriathaim and Sibma and Zareth Shahar in the mount of the valley. And Beth Peor and Ashdoth Pisgah and Beth Jezebah and all the cities of the plain and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, which reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses smote with the princes of Midian, Evi and Rekham and Zur and Hur and Reba, which were dukes of Sihon dwelling in the country. Balaam also, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, did the children of Israel slay with the sword among them that were slain by them. And the border of the children of Reuben was Jordan, and the border thereof, this was the inheritance of the children of Reuben after their families, the cities and the villages thereof. The Moabites descended from Lot would not grieve over the fate of these cities while they were being inhabited by Israel in the time of Isaiah. Here it becomes apparent that the name of Moab is being used as a sort of pejorative for the Israelites who had dwelt in the land of Moab, which the territory settled by Reuben and Gad had continued to be called long after it had become their own. While Kir and Ar seem to have been actual cities of the Moabites, if R is not Aroer, in the territory retained by the tribe of Moab south of the river Arnon, these other cities all belong to the Israelites of the tribes of Gad and Reuben. Throughout this period, the Moabites had remained loyal to Assyria, but it was Israel which would be destroyed and taken into captivity. While the language does not explicitly indicate whether this had happened during the time of Tiglath-Pileser III or during the time of one of his successors, we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, and the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And he carried them away, even the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and brought them under Halah and Habor and Hara, and to the river goes on unto this day. These are some of the same places to which the inhabitants of Samaria had been deported in the time of Sargon II, as it is recorded in 2 Kings chapters 17 and 18. So it is possible that it had not happened until that time. Verse 3. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in their streets, everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. And Heshbon shall cry, and Elealeh, their voice shall be heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out, his life shall be grievous unto him. We will also address that translation. In the citation from Joshua chapter 13, which we have just provided, it is evident that Heshbon is also a city of Reuben. So was Elealeh, which was apparently nearby, as we read in Numbers chapter 32. And the children of Reuben built Heshbon and Elealeh and Kirjathaim and Nebo and Baal-Meon, their names being changed, and I will discuss that in a moment, and Shema, and gave other names unto the cities which they built. So here it is also evident that the name of Nebo was once changed, but it is still called Nebo here in this chapter of Isaiah. The name Nebo, or also Nabu, belonged to an idol of the Assyrians and Babylonians, and it is evident in the names of the Babylonian kings, Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus. So that Nabo in Nabonidus and that Nebuchadnezzar in Nebuchadnezzar, they both are the name of this idol, Nebo. The location of the Jahaz mentioned here is not entirely certain, but it was apparently in the wilderness to the east, which is evident in Numbers chapter 21. And Sihon would not suffer Israel to pass through his border. But Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel into the wilderness. And he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. And Israel smote him with the edge of the sword and possessed his land from Arnon to Jabbok, even under the children of Ammon. For the border of the children of Ammon was strong. So Jahaz had never belonged to Moab, but to Ammon. And the Ammonites had lost their land to the Amorites at a time much earlier than when Israel had taken it for themselves. And I'm sorry, I should have wrote the Moabites had lost their land to the Amorites at a time much earlier than when Israel had taken it for themselves. While some of the territory of Reuben and Gad had once belonged to Moab, some of it had also once belonged to Ammon. Jahaz, having once belonged to Ammon, this serves to strengthen our assertion that this entire prophecy does not actually concern the Moabites, but the Israelites who had been dwelling in Moab. The text of verse 4 does not necessarily reference Moab personally, as it appears to do in the translation of the King James Version. In the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, we read, Heshbon and Elealeh are crying out, their voices heard as far as Jahaz. This is why the armed men of Moab cry aloud. Each man's soul trembles within him. So that's not personal towards Moab. It's about the armed soldiers of Moab. And Moab here is a reference to Reuben and Gad. And these are their cities. Going back to verse 1. In the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. In the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. those cities are not mourned over. But Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba and Bejith and Dibon, perhaps, depending on how you want to translate that passage. And Heshbon shall cry, and Elilah, or Eleale, and Jahaz, and all of these places that are mourned for, or that cry out, all these places belong to the children of Reuben and Gad. Verse 5, Isaiah chapter 15. My heart shall cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar, a heifer of 3 years old. For by the mounting up of Luhith with weeping they shall go it up. For the way of Horonaim they shall raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrin shall be desolate. For the hay is withered away, the grass fails, there is no green thing. And once again, here where the word of Yahweh professes to cry out for Moab, it refers to the Israelites who had dwelt in lands which formerly belonged to Moab. Some of those Israelites would apparently avoid captivity by fleeing into these surrounding countries. So, Zoar was the ancient town near the southern portion of the Dead Sea, apparently, to which Lot had fled after the destruction of Sodom, which is described in Genesis chapter 19. Zoar is described as being in the south, where Moses ascended Mount Nebo, and Yahweh had showed him the land which Israel would inherit in Deuteronomy chapter 34. The locations of Luhith, Horonaim, a word which means two caves, and Nimrim are all obscure, since they are only mentioned here and in Jeremiah chapter 48. There was a prophecy against Moab in that chapter of Jeremiah, which contains much of the same language which is found here. However, the circumstances of Israel in Jeremiah are far different than those here in the time of Isaiah. By the time of Jeremiah, most of Israel is in captivity, while the people of the Moabites south of the river Arnon had remained as loyal subjects of the Assyrians. It is plausible that they, with or without some remnant of Israelites, had spread back into their ancient land after at least most of Israel had either fled, been killed, or been taken captive. In any event, Moab had not been destroyed by the Assyrians, but Reuben and Gad had been destroyed by them. Verse 7. Isaiah chapter 15. Therefore the abundance they have gotten, and that which they have laid up, shall they carry away to the brook of the willows. For the cry is gone around about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof unto Eglaim, and the howling thereof unto Beer Elim. Every time you see beer, I mean, it sounds great. No, I'm kidding. Every time you see beer in a Hebrew place name, it refers to a well or a fountain. Beer Sheba is the well of Sheba, so Beer Elim is the well of Elim, E-L-I-M. I didn't even search to see if there was an Elim by which I could identify this. I'm going to do it real quick right now. And there is, so I guess I should find it, but no, it's far south in Sinai, so that must be a different Elim. Or the cry could be heard that far away, which is very possible. Maybe I'll write that into the notes after this presentation. The names Eglaim and Beer Elim are otherwise unknown, since they are only mentioned here, even if there's an Elim mentioned in the book of Exodus and in the book of Numbers, which is far to the south. The word translated as willows they shall carry away to the brook of the willows. And this sort of implies that these places are far away. That word is a plural form of Arab. And in some translations, it is the Brook of the Arabs, as it is in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible and in the Septuagint. Strong's defined this use of the term as willow, and the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon as poplar, specifically the variety of poplar known as Poplar euphratica, called Populus euphratica today, the poplar tree that customarily grows in the area of the Euphrates River. But they also state that the identification of this particular brook is dubious, and I would have to agree there were, at that time, there were probably hundreds or thousands of brooks throughout the region that we know now as Arabia, which is basically everything east of the Jordan River all the way to the Persian Gulf or Mesopotamia. So it would be very difficult to identify one small brook unless it was well documented in scripture. The Septuagint, as Brenton has it, in a fair representation of the Greek, has verse 7 to read, "Shall Moab even thus be delivered? For I will bring the Arabians upon the valley, and they shall take it." This would also be true of the fate of Gad and Reuben, since the Amorite and other mixed, quote-unquote, Arabian tribes of the east had also been subject to the Assyrians and conscripted into their armies. Verse 9. "For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood. For I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon him that escapes of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land." And here it is evident that perhaps the name Dimon should be understood as a reference to the place name, rather than literally to weeping. But perhaps it should be interpreted both ways, since there were many other cities in Reuben, and this one was apparently singled out here on account of the meaning of its name. "For the waters of weeping shall be full of blood, so they will have blood mixed with their tears," which happens very often in war. The Septuagint reads this verse, as Brenton has it, "And the water of Dimon shall be filled with blood, for I will bring Arabians upon Dimon, and I will take away the seed of Moab, and Ariel, and the remnant of Adama." And although it would strengthen our assertions, there seems to be an error, where the reading of the Septuagint is Ariel, or Lion of God, is the meaning of Ariel, rather than the common word for lion, which is Ariah, the final letter being an H instead of an L. Furthermore, the word Adama is reddish dirt or land, but it was rendered in the Septuagint here as a place name. Origen's Hexapla notes that other Greek translations rendered the word by its plain meaning, land, but in Field's edition, there are no notes concerning Ariel, which is weird. In both places, the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible supports that reading, which is found in the King James Version. We should repeat our assertion here that him that escapes of Moab is a reference to Israelites who would flee from the Assyrians rather than be taken into captivity by them. All of the places which may be identified here as prophecy had belonged to the Israelites who dwelt in Moab and not to the actual Moabites. We will remain confident in this assertion and see that its veracity is even more apparent in Isaiah chapter 16, which we will commence with presently. Send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness, unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. Here, rather than lamb, the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible has lambs in the plural, where the word is also apparently singular in the Hebrew of the Masoretic text. The Latin Vulgate has lamb in the singular. In any event, this is no special lamb. However, the same word was often used to describe a ram, and even a battering ram, which makes much more sense here in the overall context. The children of Israel were about to be pushed out of their land by Yahweh their God at the hands of the Assyrians. Yet, even with that, the term ruler of the land is ambiguous. However, we would translate the clause to say, send the ram who has dominion of the land, the ram that is the ruler of the land, and interpret that as a reference to the Assyrians, which is pretty clear to me from the context of the historical perspective of what is happening here. However, in the Septuagint, there is a greater difference. Where Brenton has this verse to read, I will send, as it were, reptiles on the land. Now, I don't know how you confuse ram with reptiles, because the word for lamb is very, very short. It's only two letters. And the word for reptiles is much more complex. Is not the mount of the daughter of Sion a desolate rock? On this verse, except for a note regarding the phrase daughter of Sion, the hexapla is silent. However, since only fragments from the original work have survived, a determination cannot be made as to why something is not there when it's not there. The word translated as Selah here means rock, and it is usually spelled Selah with an H at the end, where here it is wanting the H, wherever else it appears in the Old Testament. It only appears here without the H. It's the same word that has an H everywhere else. It appears often in the Old Testament because it was also the name of a city in Edom called Petra after the later Greek translation of its meaning. So Petra was originally Selah, S-E-L-A-H, in the books of the Old Testament. The editors of the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible refuted the Septuagint translation of the word, and they seem to be correct that this is a reference to Selah. Evidently, as the Israelites up to this point had both Moab and Edom as subjects from the time of David, perhaps they had spread themselves out that far in their settlements. The reference to the mount of the daughter of Zion in this particular context could refer to any settlement of Israel in the mountains east of the Jordan, as references to Zion are sometimes describing the hill in Jerusalem, but often the phrase is an allegory for the children of Israel collectively. The word daughter is often used to describe colonies or settlements of people, as in the phrase daughter of Tyre in the 45th Psalm, or both daughter of Zion and daughter of Jerusalem in Micah chapter 4, where there is a prophetic assurance that while Israel would be cast off, in verse 8 we read, thou, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion, unto thee it shall come, even the first dominion, the kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. There is a record in 2 Kings chapter 14 that the Selah in Edom was indeed taken by Judah and renamed in the days of Amaziah, the king of Judah, where we read from verse 7, he slew of Edom in the Valley of Salt 10,000 and took Selah by war and called the name of it Jokthael unto this day. Amaziah had ruled Judah for 29 years, from about 110 years before the death of Ahaz. So it is likely that Selah had probably been occupied by Israel since that time, as it was a strategic location in Edom. With that understanding, it is likely that the phrase from Selah to the wilderness unto the mount of the daughter of Zion was meant to describe all of the lands which Israel had occupied east of the river Jordan, so it would all be battered by the ram of the Assyrians. Verse 2. For it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Here the women of Israel are called the daughters of Moab as a pejorative, because the lands of Gad, and especially of Reuben, were the primary subject of this prophecy. There's nothing about the people in the Moabite cities being chased out of their cities and forced to wander. Take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcasts, bewray not him that wanders, or betray. Ancient, archaic King James Version language. Let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. And ostensibly, some Israelites would seek refuge among the Moabites and elsewhere, which is also indicated where it spoke of him that escapes of Moab in the preceding chapter. However, it may also be that the Israelites of the land of Galilee and other points in the north have tried to hide here in the lands of Reuben and Gad, since many of them have already suffered a great captivity at the hands of Tiglath-Pileser III some years before this. In any event, the outcasts here are the outcasts of Israel, as Yahweh had already assured both Israel and Judah that they would be destroyed for their sins and taken into captivity by the Assyrians. Perhaps Israel was first warned in relation to this in Numbers chapter 33. I won't get into a different passage a little earlier in Numbers uttered by Balaam, the son of Beor, but I will start here, where Israel had been told to drive out all the Canaanites, and we read, "But if you will not drive out the Canaanites of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which you let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and vex you in the land wherein you dwell. Moreover, it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them." In other words, Israel would be driven from the land because Israel refused to drive the Canaanites from out of the land. And here we are. But the first prophet to proclaim this in Israel was not Isaiah, or even Hosea or Amos. Rather, in the days of Jeroboam II, as many as 75 years before the death of Ahaz, a prophet named Ahijah had announced this to Jeroboam, who was then king of Israel, as it is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 14, where we read in part, "For Yahweh shall smite Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he shall root up Israel out of this good land which he gave to their fathers, and shall scatter them beyond the river," ostensibly a reference to the Euphrates River, "because they made their groves, provoking Yahweh to anger. And he shall give up Israel because of the sins of Jeroboam, who did sin and who made Israel to sin." comparing these sins of Israel as they were presented here in Isaiah chapter 1, and also in the other prophets of the time, Amos and Hosea. It seems that a reference to the extortioner and the oppressors describe certain of the children of Israel, and the spoiler describes the Assyrians who had been enlisted to take them into captivity. In Isaiah chapter 1, where the prophet first recounted their sins, we read a plea from Yahweh instructing them to wash you, make you clean, put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Not having done these things, they are justly called extortioners and oppressors. Evidently, having oppressed the poor of their own people. Yet in spite of their sins, there is still a promise of hope in verse 5. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. This is a messianic prophecy of Christ himself establishing his promised mercy upon the children of Israel. That was actually a subject of earlier prophecies here in Isaiah. Long after Israel was taken into captivity, in Jeremiah chapter 31, just before the promise of the new covenant, we read, "At the same time, saith Yahweh, will I be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Thus saith Yahweh, the people which were left of the sword found grace in the wilderness, even Israel, when I went to cause him to rest beyond the river, beyond the Euphrates River. Yahweh has appeared of old unto me, saying, yeah, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn thee beyond the river." This prophecy refers to the very people here who would either be slain or who would go off into Assyrian captivity. Verse 6, Isaiah chapter 16. "We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. Therefore shall Moab howl for Moab. Everyone shall howl, for the foundations of Kir Hareseth shall ye mourn. Surely they are stricken." Kir Hareseth, or in Jeremiah chapter 48, Kir Harez, in a prophecy with very much the same objectives and similar language, which I wouldn't want to discuss until I got to Jeremiah chapter 48. As I explained, the circumstances of Jeremiah are very different than they are here in Isaiah. As we have already explained, Kir Hareseth seems to be a pejorative description of Kir, which was a city in Moab. But perhaps the reference is not to Kir at all, and simply describes the efforts by which Israel may resist Assyria as a wall of potsherds. A wall being an allegory for a defense. Of course, a wall built out of pieces of broken pottery would not be a good defense, and it would not stand against the enemy. While on the surface, the pride of Moab could refer to the actual Moabites, who would naturally seek to elevate themselves after the demise of Israel, by whom they had been ruled for several hundred years, it more likely refers to the pride of the Israelites who dwelt in the land of Moab. And now there is mention once again of some of the cities of Reuben in connection with that pride. "For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah, the lords of the heathen, the lords of the nations, perhaps, had broken down the principal plants thereof, meaning the Assyrians and all of their armies from the diverse other nations. They are come even to Jazer. They wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. The lords of the heathens are the rulers of the Assyrian armies. Here we have already seen that Heshbon was the city of Reuben. And in the same passage of Joshua chapter 13, which we had cited in relation to Isaiah chapter 15, verse 2, Sibmah is also a city of Reuben in the lands which had once belonged to Moab. But while Jazer was nearby, that was a city of Gad. As we read in Joshua chapter 13, from where we had left off in our earlier citation, and where it is also evident that Heshbon was a border town between Gad and Reuben, from verse 24, and Moses gave inheritance unto the tribe of Gad, even unto the children of Gad according to their families. And their coast was Jazer, the city mentioned here, and all the cities of Gilead, and half the land of the children of Ammon, unto Aroer that is before Rabbah. And from Heshbon, unto Ramath Mizpeh and Betonim, and from Mahanaim unto the border of Debir, and in the valley Beth Aram and Beth Nimrah and Sukkoth and Zaphon and the rest of the kingdom of Sahan, king of Heshbon, Jordan and his border, even unto the edge of the Sea of Kinnereth on the other side of Jordan eastward. Therefore, it is evident here that Yahweh has continued to use the name of Moab as a pejorative for the Israelites who had dwelt in the land of Moab, as the lands were taken from the Moabites were still called long after they had become part of the kingdom of Israel. Verse 9. Therefore I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Sibmah. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon and Elealeh, for the shouting for thy summer fruits and for thy harvest is fallen. As we have explained, all these places had belonged to Israel from the time of Moses to the time when they were taken captive by the Assyrians, which is a period of nearly 700 years. Moses had passed around 1410 BC, whereupon Joshua became judge of Israel. And now it is sometime around 727 BC, around the time that Ahaz had died, according to the popular chronologies. But it can't be, in spite of the errors in the chronologies, it can't be too far off of 700 years. When the word of Yahweh had said, I will bewail the weeping of, it is evident that the father does not relish in the punishment of his children. And even Yahweh has that same empathy for Israel, as he must punish them for their iniquity. As it continues, he expresses that once again. And gladness is taken away, and joy out of the plentiful field. And in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage shouting to cease. Wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab, and my inward parts for Kir Haresh. The bowels sounding like a harp, they groan on account of the necessity for which he had to punish his children. And moving on to verse 12. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. The reference to the high place could describe an altar or grove, or simply a mountaintop, a hilltop. However, throughout Scripture, the children of Israel were chastised for worshiping idols in the high places, where it's very clear. Here, too, this seems to depict the Israelites of Gad and Reuben as beseeching their idols as they are attacked by the Assyrians, rather than turning to Yahweh their God. However, even if they had prayed to him, they would still be taken into captivity for their sins, as he had already assured by the mouths of his prophets, at least from the time of Ahijah in the days of Jeroboam II. So now there is a conclusion. Verse 13. This is the word that Yahweh had spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now Yahweh has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of the hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be contemned, with all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. The Assyrian records showed that Moab, the kingdom of the Moabites south of the Arnon River, had remained an obedient subject throughout this entire period, and it was never destroyed at this time. But soon after this time, as the text here states explicitly, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh were taken off into Assyrian captivity, as we have read in 1 Chronicles chapter 5. The burden of Moab is the burden of the Israelites who had dwelt in Moab. And the Moabites themselves had never been considered as candidates for the mercy of Yahweh, the God of Israel. As Christ himself had said, as it is recorded in Matthew chapter 12, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God," or the Lord our God, "is one Lord." The word Adon. "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God." "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God." When are Christians ever going to understand those simple words? Probably never. This concludes our commentary on Isaiah through chapter 16. Never in this life. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and not the God of the Moabites or anybody else. And thank you for listening.